Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, reckoning with the loss and the need and the redemption of recovery. On the many nights that Leslie Jamison was intoxicated in her 20s, she scrawled a question into her diary. Is this what it's like to be an alcoholic? It would take her years of drinking and blackouts and shame to answer that question. And her new book is partly about that. But it's also about what it means to commit to recovery, an aftermath that we typically regard as cold and weary and an unending slog. Not for Jamison. I wanted to know if stories about getting better, she writes, could ever be as compelling as stories about falling apart. Today, a discussion about recovery from addiction. And as our guests join us, I think we'd like to hear your voice in this conversation, too. Have you come through addiction and are in a short or long-term recovery? What's your recovery revealed to you about resilience and self-compassion? So I think we are interested, of course, in the addiction part of this, but most interested this hour in what that recovery has meant to you. And I want to know about how you had to bring the forces of self-compassion and resilience to work on your recovery. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. Leslie Jamison is the author of The Recovering Intoxication and Its Aftermath, and she's with us today from LA. And Leslie, welcome. Wonderful book. I'm so glad you could be with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Joseph Lee is with us, medical director of Hazelden's Youth Services and author of Recovering My Kids. And he's also in L.A. And Dr. Lee, sorry to not have you in the studio, but good to talk to you this morning. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, I'm in San Diego, but love being on your show. So good, thanks for having me again.
Good to have you. Leslie, that question of whether recovery could ever be as compelling as addiction was tied up with the fact that you're a writer. And you were kind of swept into this mythology that I think we hold, that there's something glamorous and interesting about the writer who is a slave to his addictions. So I'd like to know how that influenced the way you started looking at your recovery.
Well, it was certainly a fear that I had when I was still drinking and wanted very desperately to be a writer, that somehow the creative impulse was bound up in a kind of generative pain, and that one of the manifestations of that generative pain might be kind of addictive drinking, and that addictive drinking was a sign of a kind of interior darkness, the same sort of interior darkness that might produce beauty or great work. And I'd really inherited a lot of mythologies around, you know, great drunken writers who'd come before Raymond Carver, John Cheever, John Berryman, the poet, and his beautiful dream songs, a professor at the University of Minnesota for many years. And so I think that I had sort of inherited many of those legends, and that fear that somehow getting sober was going to do something to my creativity was tied up with a fear that I think almost any user has, almost any addicted user has, which is like, what is life going to look like without this substance?
And Joseph Lee, that's the natural question, isn't it? Like, can I be what I consider to be so essential about me without the addiction?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I should start by saying, Leslie, I loved your book, and so I wish we were in studio so you could sign it for me. But I heard so many of the voices of just the thousands of, I guess, unofficial biographies I've done for young people, young women in particular, young artists. I see a lot of them, musicians, writers, people who are in theater, and they wrestle with this essential question about, as Leslie puts it beautifully, this kind of cosmic sadness, this suffering that produces creativity and gives some kind of you know, illumination, you know, to their work. And a lot of them are afraid sometimes that if they give up their using, that they will surrender that, that they'll be somehow broken. And I think Leslie did a beautiful job of describing how that's actually not true, that while the temptation is there and there's this delusion that this creativity has to thrive upon personal suffering, that's actually not the case. There are many artists who just put a lot of work into it, and they might be somewhat eccentric, but they are not kind of self-destructive. And so I thought it was a very hopeful message and a very important point to make about addiction and recovery.
You know, Leslie, I almost got the sense that you could tell yourself in the midst of this addiction, well, I'm suffering like my creative heroes have suffered, and maybe this is the rite of passage that I have to go through. I mean, you stepped into that belief for a long time and in some ways let it continue, believing that it was going to contribute to your art somehow. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was certainly one of the stories I was telling myself about why I was using, and a way of attaching a certain kind of profundity to the using. There's a, at least for me in my drinking, there was a kind of grandiosity that could attend the sort of narrative of my life, and a kind of drama that I wanted to inject into the script. And one of the engines of that drama was certainly that, you know, maybe my drinking was taking me into a kind of darkness that was reminiscent of those old legends. I think I never really kid myself. My drinking was never as dramatic in its, in many of its externals, as theirs was. But I think that that sense of being in touch with something dark and deep was certainly part of the lure.
Can I also say, Leslie, that I also, in one of the takeaways that I had from the memoir, was when you stripped away the details of the addiction, your arrival at sobriety feels pretty familiar to me from other, you know, from other memoirs and accounts, the people who have come to the place where they have to get sober arrive. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I think that that sense of commonality between stories, and the way that many, many stories can share something in common kind of underneath their diverging specifics, and that commonality is a kind of saving grace, is really one of the premises of fellowship-based recovery. And so the fact that there was something reminiscent about my arrival at recovery feels absolutely right. I think one of the things that I wanted to do was write a book that differed a little bit from books that I had read in the past, insofar as the recovery part of the story wasn't just a couple of chapters
right.
at the end.
The but aftermath, was really, right, wrapped yeah. up very quickly. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to kind of do justice to that part of the story as something rich and complicated and compelling as well.
And if you've just tuned into the conversation, you hear us focusing on the idea of recovery and the process and what life is like on the other side, going through recovery. I don't mean that recovery ever ends, but what it means to experience recovery. And I'm asking you, if you've come through addiction, you're in a short or a long-term recovery. And I want to know what your recovery has revealed to you about the idea of resilience and self-compassion, right? How you're dealing with that, what you're taking on about that. 651-227-6000 and on Twitter at @CarrieNPR. And if you're outstate, 800-242-2828 to Jeff in St. Louis Park. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. One of the tragedies of addiction is we become who we're not. And recovery means we can begin to rediscover who we really are and live, you know, live more frequently directly related to our values. And I remember early in my recovery back in the 70s, I went out with a girlfriend and a couple of her friends, and they said during the dinner, well, the guy looked at me and he said, "You're having more fun than we are, and you're not even drinking." And then we all kind of laughed, but that was a real affirmation that I could have fun, I could enjoy others as well as myself, and be more of who I really am.
Good to have your call. Yeah, Jeff, thank you. Dr. Lee, does that sound familiar? Does that resonate with you, this idea of I've lost who I really am, and this is about re-encountering that person?
Definitely. And Leslie talks about that in many different angles, about people trying to fill a kind of void, and you're trying to drum up the suffering, and maybe it's legitimate, maybe it's less so, who knows, on a relativity scale. But, you know, when people suffer or they use substances, they're looking for that kind of deeper, profound meaning, and they're trying to find themselves. But ironically, through that search, they lose the very thing that they're seeking. And then the flip side of that is when Leslie talks about people going to meetings or getting therapy, there's a cliched kind of commonality to it that's very humble, and it at first doesn't seem original at all, because it's not. You're just like a lot of other people. But the function of that communion and fellowship and the spiritual growth is really there to engage and pass on and to help others, and then that actually brings people to life, and then they actually find themselves in it. So it's a strange irony that the more you try to focus very specifically on who you want to be and how profound you want to be, you sometimes lose yourself. And then sometimes by investing yourself in other people, you actually find yourself. And we see that a lot.
You know, Leslie, Joseph reminds me of you going to some of your meetings, and you went through this twice, and you would want to show up initially when you were going to AA meetings. You'd want to show up with the most fascinating, interesting accounts, right, of your addiction, because you wanted to impress the people in the room.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I should say that a lot of what Joseph just said, it resonated so much, and I think especially that idea of the irony of losing yourself once your life becomes sort of very self-fixated in the way that addiction can make a life. And I say that not in a judgmental way, but just that I think the state of enthrallment sort of can make the horizon of your life very small, and that is actually often ends up feeling like a loss of self. And then there's, you know, either a kind of rediscovery of self that can happen in sobriety and recovery, or a kind of a creation of self that can happen in those spaces as well. And yeah, I think when I first went into recovery, I felt very liberated by hearing other people's stories in meetings. I felt the immediate resonance of, like, this person talks about drinking in a way that chimes with how I feel mm-hmm. about drinking. But I also felt like it was great to just show up in a room and engage with other people's lives for a while. But I certainly also felt that desire to kind of be the best storyteller in the room, or to compel other people with my stories. But I also knew from very early on that I didn't have an incredibly dramatic addiction story. And I think I felt early that what I wanted to do was to be useful to people in the room in the way that their stories were from the very start very useful to me.
I mean, what you just said about, you know, you learned pretty quickly that while the details might be different, there was a real commonality to that experience of addiction. Is that something that, I mean, that you don't really understand until you get into a room and you truly listen, you lean in and listen to other people talking about their addiction? Leslie, what's your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly very powerful to me. Things like, you know, as a writer and as an aspiring writer, I had always learned to distrust cliches, to make sure that my writing never included them. And one of the things that was a little bit difficult for me at first in meetings was hearing a lot of cliches and, you know, One Day at a Time and other pieces of recovery wisdom. But what became very powerful for me was realizing cliches become cliches for a reason. And it doesn't mean all of our novels now need to include cliches, but that there are these deep wells of truth kind of inside each of those simple phrases. And part of the beauty of those phrases is that those truths can resonate different ways for people with very different external lives, but that the truths themselves can become these kind of subterranean rivers connecting those lives, or these kind of linkages between those lives. So I ultimately ended up feeling there was something really beautiful about the way that a cliche could link me to somebody who had come from a very different set of experiences than I had.
Call here from Wendy in Minnetonka. Hey, Wendy, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi, sure. Hi. I'm a creative writer, and I'm wondering if your guests see parallels between treating addiction and recovering from addiction and treating mental illness like depression and anxiety, because I've been through this experience, and fear really have feared losing my creative self. as I sensed the world and reacted to the world and interpreted it before. So I'm just wondering if they see those parallels.
Sure. Leslie, you first on that, if you would.
Yeah, well, and I'd be really curious to hear Joseph weigh in as it was more of a professional on this. But, I mean, I can certainly, for me, my own mental illness struggles were primarily with depression, and my depression never felt like a particularly creatively generative space. But I know, actually, my aunt does quite a bit of work on the connection between manic depression and creativity, and I know that some of the fears are very shared, the idea that in losing touch with manic highs, you might lose touch with your creative font. And, you know, for me, that idea that recovery was going to potentially sever my ties with the kind of drama and intensity of what addiction felt like. But I can just say for myself, you know, part of what I started to experience was that addiction, the state of enthrallment, became quite tedious and repetitive, and it didn't really feel creatively generative at all. And the kind of counterpoint to that was that sobriety was where life kind of was allowed to unfold and become a bit more expansive. And so that fear, while it is one that I identify with quite strongly, it actually didn't play out that way at all.
Joseph, what would you say about that?
Yeah, I don't know if it gets to the heart of what Wendy's asking, but I have two really good examples that I see in clinical practice all the time. So I see these people with mental health issues and depression, and some of them actually are torn. They're pretty ambivalent about whether they want to be undepressed, if that's a word, because they know they're suffering. But I think as a protective mechanism psychologically, they develop a kind of smugness about the world, and they feel enlightened, and so they feel like they've woken up, you know, in an artificial world, and they know what love is like, and they know how people really are, and they know how corrupt society really is, and that kind of smug view, and Leslie also talks about this very well. I found myself kind of mapping a lot of my experiences and working with patients onto her book, so I thought it was great, but they don't want to surrender that. So a part of them wants to get well because they're depressed, but another part of them doesn't want to let go of this viewpoint they have. They think they have this vantage point that's very unique that in the end isn't. And then I have another example of artists that of many kinds, they come in and they have this unspoken wager with themselves and self-destruction. And the wager goes something like this. They adopt some kind of self-destruction, whether it's using substances or maybe it's an eating disorder or poor hygiene or whatever. But the arts are a very subjective field. And when they adopt this kind of self-destructiveness, and society loves it because we love the Hemingways and the Kurt Cobains and we love these artists. And so when they adopt a certain kind of self-destructive way of living, if they don't succeed, they can always use that kind of as a hedge, like, oh, I could have been a great something, but I was self-destructive. And on the other hand, if they do succeed, well, then it seems that their genius was all the more great, because even if they were self-destructive, they couldn't stop this kind of powerful force of creativity that came out. And the truth is that most artists in the world are not this, that we stigmatize it and remember it and dramatize it that way. But that's not necessarily how all artists are, that a lot of artists come to creativity through hard work, through some ingenuity of their own that they discover through various life experiences. And Leslie points this out well. I think there's a quote from her book where she talks about one problem with living as if your sadness takes up the whole world is that it never does. And I thought that was just so profound. And there were all these kinds of really profound statements that I could see my clients sharing with me as they go through their journey of the ups and downs of recovery, that they really initially feel like their independence, their uniqueness, their creativity is tied to this suffering and this view that they have. And they come to find out later that, ironically, it's these cliches and these cultures and these connections with people that transforms them.
Joseph, I have to say, as I listened to you describe that, I realized, and you know this, that I interview a lot of writers on stage and for the show, and I realize that I've contributed to that too. Just this sense of it's a special kind of truth that comes out of, right, this experience that you've had with addiction. I think the media contributes, and I myself have contributed to this idea that it's not just glamorous, it's also you've got some kind of extraordinary insight because you've been through this.
Yeah, and I think Leslie describes that really well in how we have these weird views of addiction, that we see them We see people with addiction as kind of criminals, especially if they're minorities or women, and we see them as other than. But when we love them, when we love them and they're included in our circle, then we empathically and sometimes mistakenly look for explanations for their kind of the dissonance in their lives. And I think that's where some of this this trope comes from, where we try to find madness and genius together. I don't think it's because of something that is callous. I think it's born because we love some of these artists and their work, and we're trying to find an explanation for it. I think Leslie refers to it kind of in a social sense as a respectability politics. But I think that's where some of that comes from.
Leslie, you were going to say?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I absolutely agree with that idea that, you know, we look for ways to make sense of the suffering we experience. And I think it's a, you know, I think Joseph used the phrase psychological defense mechanism, or a kind of an adaptive strategy to start to think of that pain and suffering as useful. I guess I wanted to point out that I think sometimes the experience of addiction and certain kinds of deep psychic anguish, I mean, they really can yield beauty, and they really can yield kind of creative acts of creative genius. And one of the things that I found when I was writing my book was that at first I kind of wanted to push back against that wholly, to say, oh, this is just a mythology that addiction and creativity have anything to do with each other. You know, the wanted to almost find proof that, like, all of the best creativity came from states of sobriety or wellness or recovery. But really what I came to find in the case studies that I examined and to some extent in my own life was that, you know, at one point I say the lie wasn't that addiction could hold truth. The lie was that addiction had some kind of monopoly on it. And so in that way, I want to honor the ways that people write beautiful things, beautiful accounts of all sorts of experiences, addiction among them, and there are truths in those accounts. But it's really the toxic part is this idea that there can't be this kind of incredibly electric potential for writing and for living in that kind of aftermath of recovery as well.
If you've just tuned in, that's exactly what we're talking about. What does the aftermath of addiction look like? It's something that Leslie Jamison has focused on in her new memoir, The Recovering Intoxication and Its Aftermath. And Dr. Joseph Lee is with us, medical director for Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation's Youth Services. We're talking about a lot of the mythology around intoxication and addiction, what's misunderstood, what should be better understood about recovery. And that's where you're adding your voice to this, and it's really valuable. I'm wondering about whether you're in short or long-term recovery, and what your recovery has revealed to you about your own resilience and your creativity and your self-compassion. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And to the phones to Christian in Cannon Falls. Christian, thank you so much for waiting. I know it's been a while. We have a lot of people on the phone lines, but thank you.
That's all right. I'm actually on the road to Cannon Falls. I'm from Minneapolis and in recovery 25 years now.
Right.
So,
what are you thinking about?
Well, a couple things. One thing that really caused me to pull over is when Leslie made this comment that a fellowship-based recovery, and I got sober in program, and I'm not going to say the name, but everybody knows the name, by just going to meetings and showing up, really being washed up, you know, Minnesota kid, San Francisco, looking at the backseat of my Jetta as my new domicile. And I was done. And as much as I loved drinking and using and getting high, it was my favorite thing, it ended. And I think one of the problems that we have is addicts and alcoholics, just lump them together, you know, they treat loneliness with isolation. And within that isolation, thought patterns occur. And they are repetitive. And they are almost kind of like polished and loved, and that depression, that very loneliness, that very problem, that being completely addicted and looking at either death or giving it up, you know, you actually embrace that. And I think Dr. Joe was just talking about that a little bit. You know, I went to a very fine prep school here in Minneapolis growing up, and I was, you know, got out fine and did great at the U. And my moniker was, you know, if I wasn't getting high every day, boy, would I'd be at Harvard, you know. I mean, that's the story we tell ourselves.
Right.
Now, let me give you a little story on...
Hey, Christian, please forgive me that we have so many people that want to get in on this. May I ask you to expedite this a little?
Yep, that's it.
Thank
you. So that's my story. Took up bluegrass guitar, met a master in San Francisco at age 40. Age 55, I won the bluegrass contest at the state fair here.
Jeez.
You're more
nicely
creative
done.
When you're sober. So that's it. Bye.
Dr. Lee, what did you hear in what Christian was saying about the polishing of the beliefs and what that meant in his life?
Yeah, what I love is just people in recovery just bursting to share their story. And the function of it is very different. I think Leslie talks about an author, and I misplaced them because she did such a good job of kind of almost creating a pantheon of these struggling writers. But one of them was talking about sharing his story in AA a lot and how he did a really eloquent job of sharing his story, but that didn't get him well. But it was, the transformation really came in some of the commonality and fellowship, like the caller was saying. And so the stories are articulate and they're elaborate, and sometimes they're very unique to the public. But the function of it is different. The function of it isn't to sound good or to stand out. It's actually to share and to invest and become involved in other people's lives. And so that's what I hear in a lot of callers, like the last gentleman.
You know, Leslie, one of the things that struck me was you got sober twice, and you write about this constant negotiating that you did with yourself about whether you could get back to drinking without letting it consume you. And I think this helps us understand how you got to this place where you decided it had to be sobriety. Would you just talk about some of those times when you thought, no, I can live this like everybody else lives this, and then I've got it all, right? I've got the drinking and the creativity, and I don't have to do this hard thing of sobriety. And I don't have to change my life that much.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this goes to what Joseph was saying about the way in which, like, certain things are just held in common. I mean, I think there are very few addicts or alcoholics who haven't told themselves some version of the story. Well, if I just shift the drinking or the using like this, maybe I'll be able to do it better or manage it. So for me, the stories included, well, I'm going to, you know, if I'm not going to drink on Mondays, or I'm only going to drink wine, or, you know, I'm only going to let myself get drunk three nights a week, and all these kind of management plans that were really just an expression of this deep fear that I had about what was life going to look like without the drinking at all. So I kept trying to write scripts in which the drinking would work in a way that I could kind of keep my hands on the reins. And I think that for me, it was very powerful. The first time I went into recovery, at a certain point, once the kind of memory of the shame and the damage had receded enough in the rearview mirror, I started to tell myself, well, maybe, you know, maybe I can really drink better. And, you know, it was powerful because, you know, at one point I was reading a passage in the Big Book, and, you know, it said the great fantasy of every drinker is the idea that he could manage his drinking better. And, you know, I felt very recognized by that, like I had been seen through, right, because that was my great fantasy too. But it didn't stop me from having it, and I kind of went back out and drank for another 9 months to see whether it was in fact true that I could manage the drinking better, and I couldn't. But it was ultimately, rather than feeling like that 9 month relapse was some kind of failure, it really became quite useful for me to think about, well, that was my experiment, and that mm-hmm. was where it took me, and it was a useful kind of self-knowledge, and then became something also that I shared with other people as part of my story, that it included a bit of raggedness and that relapse rather than just being the kind of neat, clear arc that sometimes people want sobriety to be.
I asked if you'd read a couple paragraphs from some work you did with a therapist. Now, remind me, is this the second time that you've gone back to your experiment of can I manage the drinking, and it's getting beyond your control, and you're seeing a therapist? Is that at that point?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So this was kind of after I had been in recovery once. I mean, one of many attempts to stop drinking, but there was kind of an extended one. And then I went back to drinking, and this passage sort of appears once I'm back in drinking, but where it's clear that it's sort of going the same destructive way that it had before.
Thank you.
that fall, I put an incredible amount of effort into talking to my therapist about everything but drinking. I told her stories about my fights with Dave, but carefully talked around the booze, a tumor I'd excised. I was also starting to cut myself again, like the holes you cut in the crust of a pie to let out the steam as it bakes. One day, Dave caught sight of the cuts on my ankles and asked if I wanted to talk about it. I said I didn't. The pages of my diary were filling up with drunken scrawls. I believe there are things in me that are beautiful. When is enough? Then farther down, the writing bigger and messier. I know I've drunk a bottle and a half of wine and the N trailing off. Another night. I don't know. And I didn't. When I finally told my therapist about the drinking, it was because I was tired of running laps around it. It gets so bad when I'm drunk, I told her and started crying and couldn't stop. I was already thinking about how our conversation was going to pollute my drinking that night, like a piece of hair stuck in the back of my throat. I asked her what she saw when she looked at me. Shame, she said. There is no other word for what I see on your face.
Joseph, I'm interested in what you hear in that passage.
Yeah, I think she speaks for so many people, I think, across the country who need to get help. And I think it's just a really honest appraisal of the suffering that people go through, that, you know, there is no static nirvana people find through using. It changes because we are, as creatures, adaptable. And even if we try to control it or moderate it, some of us, just genetically, environmentally, or otherwise, and some combination therein, just can't do it. And over time, they get tired of the lies, the fights, the laps around their minds, and then they come clean with it, and then they find their values within. And that's really part of their starting journey. And I find that in her book, you know, whether people have body image issues or eating disorder issues, or they cut, or they struggle with depression or insecurities, there's so many common touching points that I think people can find inspirational, mainly because in many ways the book starts with kind of her recovery and then some of the mucky journey initially, and then her really finding her pace. And so I think it's really inspirational to hear that, and I think it's going to be inspirational for a lot of people who read it.
Call here from Stace in Minneapolis. Hi, thank you very much for waiting.
Hi, this is a great discussion. I've been in recovery for 5 years, and this is my favorite thing to talk about. I'm so grateful for my addiction, because, I mean, even before I was addicted to every drug you could do. I was anxious and judgmental and offended all the time. And, you know, I came from kind of the generation where everyone had to be authentic and live your true self, or whatever that means, and find your own way. And that led me into doing drugs alone in a room all the time. Mm-hmm. And that was the way I protested things I didn't feel right about the government or what was happening in society. But now, being in recovery, I found there's so much freedom in this framework of, you know, the 12 steps, or I'm part of a church called Serenity Village and all the things that we do. There's so much under that umbrella and this path that's been laid out. I don't have to find my own way. And inside of that, I like everything I could imagine is coming true, and not just necessarily like material things, but just peace and the ability to interact with someone I disagree with and not become enraged or whatever. So,
you know, Stacey, your use of the word freedom, though, really, it reminded me of something that I made a note of in Leslie's memoir, which is, Leslie, I think you describe what you think of as the freedom of drinking. You say drinking felt like the opposite of restriction. It was giving into the wanting rather than refusing it. And of course, at the beginning, I'm sure recovery felt like nothing but restriction. But what about what Stace says about freedom? I mean, I'm sure that makes sense now.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, so much of what Stace said rings true, and I certainly, you know, that idea of using drugs as a form of kind of social protest was something that was true for some of the writers that I look at in the book. So William Burroughs and this more obscure writer named George Kane, who was an African-American novelist who wrote beautifully about kind of thinking about heroin use as a form of social protest, but coming to find that the use itself just felt like claustrophobia and dependence. And for me, yeah, at first, drinking did feel, there was something that felt expansive, unpredictable, freeing about it. Like I wasn't going to deny myself. I wasn't going to deny myself this kind of thing I craved so much, the booze I craved so much. And it meant, you know, I would never know where a night was going to end up. And that felt like freedom. But at a certain point, you know, what Stace said about just using alone in a room, that was also exactly where the kind of last nights of my drinking took me, literally just bringing a bottle of whiskey alone into a room and closing the door so I could drink as much as I wanted. And you know, that feels like something other than freedom. And, you know, recovery at first did feel a lot like deprivation. I was depriving myself this thing, this horizon of relief that I'd come to depend on at the end of every day. But what ultimately did feel freeing was that this mental obsession that had grown so strong for me, always thinking about drinking, when was it going to happen? How is it going to happen? To not have that obsession dominating my mind every morning from the time I woke up was this really kind of a deeply, deeply freeing state.
Are there times, though, you miss the obsession in some ways? Do you know what I'm saying? It occupied a lot of mind space.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes, you know, we'll miss things about the booze itself, like that kind of that buzz state, that sort of like before it verges into too much, that, you know, Joseph used the phrase static nirvana. And I think that kind of that early buzz when you're just starting to feel your mind kind of loosened is something that I really kept chasing for many, many years. And sometimes I miss that. Sometimes I miss the feeling of certain kinds of booze in certain seasons. But that state of obsession itself, I can say that I think that is one thing I really don't miss. It really felt like a straitjacket. It felt like an internal straitjacket, and it made it hard to think about anything else. And there's so much else out there to think about and to kind of explore and to encounter. And so I think that I'm just happy to be in that state of sort of a bit of a broader life.
You know, Joseph, I was thinking, I think it was Christian who started his story a bit with, and I was using drugs and I was drinking a lot and I loved it and I loved being high. You know, do we let people say that? Because that is a part of their experience.
Oh, yeah, that's totally a part of their experience. And I think you have to allow people to let that breathe. Now, you don't want to light that on fire because they know that that's short-lived. And again, your body will adapt and it won't be the same if you keep repeating that behavior. But that's absolutely what draws people back, that nostalgia, the wanting it the first time, and Leslie talks about it. I think there are three, to make our conversation a bit concrete so audiences can listen to it, there are three things I talk about in recovery a lot with my clients. Mm-hmm. And they're all values. One of them is empathy. And the second one is humility. And the third is grace. And if you read Leslie's book, you can see the transformation within. When she was younger, she talked about this insatiable hunger, this need, not only for substances, but for the affection from her father or from certain men. And you're never free when you're always hungry and chasing something. And later on in her recovery, you see these values come into play. You see that she wasn't able to be fully empathic like she was capable of being because she was so obsessed with her own suffering and her insecurities and what was going on in her play-by-play of her own mind. And when she got into recovery, she was able to be empathic and listen and live the life for other people. And then humility is what actually ends up freeing a lot of people, because when you stop chasing, when you're okay just being who you are, but not being some special magical snowflake, just like the rest of us, you're just a human being as broken as the rest of us, mm-hmm. There's a huge freedom in that because there's no pressure to be anything else. And through that, people can find confidence. And finally, the grace you know, not telling yourself or other people that you have to earn affection, that you have to earn this and earn that. It's not some weird meritocracy, but an acceptance through empathy that we all kind of fall in life and that we are all broken and that we all need a redemption story. And I found those themes to be very powerful and validating through Leslie's book. And then one final public service announcement is, while we're talking about recovery kind of in AA format, of course, you know, there are a lot of people listening who just need to get help. And AA doesn't have a monopoly on recovery. There's lots of different ways to get sober. AA is certainly one way. Therapy is another. There's many different kinds of evidence-based therapies. And I just urge for people, if some part of this conversation is resonating with them, to just get help of any kind and just get your journey started.
Joseph, you never disappoint. I'm really grateful for the insight and for your willingness to be on the show.
No, I mean, I love this stuff. I wish we could talk this kind of stuff over coffee for hours and hours.
Thank you for the time this morning. Leslie, I chose a song by Amy Winehouse, not because, and yes, it is the one you might expect about rehab, not for its obviousness, but also because of some of the conclusions that you draw from going back to try to understand her short life and her creativity. And I wondered if you'd speak to that for a minute.
Yeah, well, I think the public obsession with Amy Winehouse as this tragic figure, and, you know, I think there's a particular public obsession with, like, the self-destructive, beautiful woman. I was really interested in kind of interrogating that obsession with her damage, and particularly this fantasy that that she never wanted help or never wanted to get better, and rehab kind of becomes the anthem of that, like, you know, the refusal of rehab. But, you know, when you look at her life, it was much more complicated than that. She did go to rehab. I think she went to rehab 4 times. And so there was some part of her that wanted to live a different way. I know she was also really wanted to be a mother. And so when I look at the tragedy of her life, I think not of somebody who was just refusing the idea of wellness, but the idea of somebody who also part of her really craved that. And I think about, you know, what might it have looked like if she had, you know, gotten sober, or stayed sober, and not this idea that that would have destroyed her, the beautiful art that she made, but, like, what kind of art might have emerged from that? It's a kind of a zone of unfulfilled possibility, and so I wonder in that direction in the book.
I'm glad you do. It reminds us as admirers and fans of someone's work, like Amy Winehouse's, that we could have. We want to make sure we give the space and the understanding, I guess, to the art that comes out of the experience on the other side, which is exactly what your whole book is about. But I thought she was a great example of this. Leslie Jameson's book is called The Recovering Intoxication and Its Aftermath. Leslie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no,
no, no. This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.